Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte has an affordable housing shortage, and the city is working on it. Voters also approved $50 million in bonds last November dedicated to buying, building, and restoring affordable housing. But Pam Kelly with the Charlotte Journalism Collaborative has been investigating what's happening around the country to provide housing for low-income people, and she joins us later in the program to share some of what she's found. First, though, the power of imagination and its influence in art, specifically that of artist Tony DiTerlizzi. He has written and illustrated over 20 children's books and served as illustrator on many more. You may know him from his award-winning illustrations for the book The Spider and the Fly, or his children's books based on the Star Wars film series, Star Wars, The Adventures of Luke Skywalker, Jedi Knight. 150 pieces of his artwork are on display. Well, actually, it'll be opening over the weekend at the Mint Museum on Randolph Road in an exhibit called Never Abandon Imagination. And Tony DiTerlizzi joins us for the first part of the program. Welcome to the show. Nice to have you here.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Many people may know your work, so if you'd like to join our conversation, you're welcome to. You can reach us through at charlottetalks@wfae.org through email, or search for us on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also watch us on Facebook Live this morning. So you are famous for your illustrations in the world of fantasy fiction and I guess fantasy art. You've helped illustrate the game Dungeons and Dragons. Man.
Dungeons and Dragons. Yes, yes.
Your works include drawings of trolls and fairies and wizards and elves and how old are you? And goblins and of course, dragons.
Yes.
And any creature that you can possibly imagine.
That's correct, yeah.
Crept into your work.
It's crowded in here, Mike. It's very crowded.
Where do you think that comes from?
You know, I was that kid that sat in the back of the classroom and just drew all the time. You know, the teacher would be, you know, at the front of the classroom, you know, talking and teaching, and I'd be drawing. And not only would I be drawing, I'd be making sound effects when I would draw. I'd be like, I think.
That's distracting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I was often spoken to about it, too. I think it was partly because I was never drawing a picture. I think it was more like a little scene, like a little movie was unspooling in my imagination, and I was trying to capture like a moment of that.
When did that start for you? When did that happen? Can you remember when you actually began doing that?
I was very young in elementary school. I mean, I grew up in an artsy-fartsy household. I mean, Mom stayed home with all three of us kids, and she drew with us. And so, I mean, I've been drawing and coloring since I was a toddler.
So your mom was an artist.
Yeah.
You also took art lessons, I know, in school.
Yeah, I went to art school, yeah. But by then, I mean, I'm 18 years old. I've been drawing for 18 years.
You were already doing it.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
So where do you think that comes from, the ability? I can't draw a straight line. So where do you think the ability comes from? To do that.
I've thought about this a lot because I couldn't sing a note if I tried, right? I mean, but then I wonder if I did it over and over again for 18 years, could I have become a singer? I mean, I don't know. In other words, I don't know if it's a learned skill.
Do you listen to music today?
Yeah.
Yes, the answer is yes.
With auto-tune, I can sing any song you want. I think it's partly that I just never stopped doing it. I think I just always loved doing it, but so did a lot of other kids, right?
Right.
I mean, a lot of kids draw and color when they're young. So I think there was probably some accrued talent going just by repeating it over and over again. Maybe there's some kind of other brain wiring that adds to it, but I don't know about that.
Do you have any of your early work, childhood elementary school work?
Not only do we have some of it, we put it in the exhibition as
well.
And the reason we did that is I don't know if this ever happened to you, but you've ever gone in a museum and you're just like, I just don't even know how they paint this or sculpted this or did this. And I feel the same way. Even as a person who makes art for a living, I'll look at a Norman Rockwell painting. I'm like, I don't know how he did that. Like, that's amazing. I can't do that. And so I don't want children to feel that when they go in there. So instead, what I wanted to do is show them what I was drawing when I was 10, what I was drawing in middle school, what I was drawing in high school, so that perhaps they could see that and go, well, I can kind of draw about as good as he did when he was that age.
When you look at that from middle school, high school, grade school, do you see, is there a through line? Do you see, oh, that's me. That's definitely my style. That's where it came from.
Yeah.
I may be better today.
Yeah.
But that's where it came from.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think I am like a kind of get to, you know, I make a living at being 10. You know, I mean, I'm drawing the same stuff and essentially accessing that part of my brain over and over again and mining it to make books for children today.
What about that? What is it about drawing goblins and fairies and wizards and things like that that captured you as a young person and continues to satisfy you today?
You know, I think it really starts to manifest in middle school for me. I mean, I think, again, in elementary school, I'm drawing, you know, Star Wars had come out. I was drawing Star Wars. I was drawing dinosaurs. Again, a lot of other kids. In middle school, that's, you know, for me, as it probably was for a lot of your listeners, it's a rough time. Like 6th and 7th and 8th grade is pretty brutal for a kid. Mm-hmm. And I think that's my yearning for escapism really began. So Dungeons and Dragons had come out in the 80s when I was in middle school, and that led to a love of, you know, reading J.R.R. Tolkien or Conan the Barbarian or, you know, Elric or any of the other fantasy books that were big at the time, and also fairy tales, because the really good fairy tales are dark and there's a lot of escapism in it. And I think for me, to be honest with you, I somehow felt like I related more to the monsters than I did the heroes in those stories.
Right. You know? But they don't exist. And you say, no. You say imagination is a world of possibility that exists within each of us. It gives us hope, calls us to action, and leads to change. Everybody has an imagination.
Sure.
Particularly when you're a child. But as we grow older, we tend to tamp that down for whatever reason and kind of maybe even lose the ability to imagine. And so we depend on people like you to help us imagine, because you create these worlds that don't exist.
Right.
How were you able to maintain and nurture and expand on your native imagination over time?
I think I'm fortunate that I had parents that saw something and nurtured it. I think I'm fortunate that I had teachers. I mean, I grew up in Florida. I went to public schools, so nothing special about the schools I went to. But I had teachers along the way that saw something that I didn't see. And I think they were able to encourage it and keep it. If you can, you know, to use a lousy metaphor, like a flame. They kept that little flame kind of going, probably during times when I would have easily snuffed it out, especially in high school. By the time I get to high school, you know, I'm the art nerd. I'm the pariah of the social, you know, the world of high school, of like jocks, and in Florida would have been the surfers . And then here's a guy who's drawing fairies and goblins and dragons, and I love Dungeons and Dragons. Like,
line up, ladies.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I was actually going to ask you about that, because you said that you fiercely held on to your imagination in that transition from childhood to adulthood. I was going to ask you if there was a price to pay for that, because particularly during high school, when you're the kid drawing dragons and fairies and goblins, and everybody else is doing whatever they do in high
school. About their mullets and their moose.
That's
and
right,
their,
it's Florida. It's,
yeah. Well, I was going to say it was the 80s, but yes, it's also Florida. Business in the front, party in the back. You know, there were, when I look back now, I see moments that were very transformative. So, for instance, in my senior year, I had taken all the art classes you could take, and my art teacher at the time, Tom Wetzel, it took me under his wing. He had a planning period. I don't know. I never knew what they did during a planning period. I figured most teachers just go smoke a cigarette or go drink a cup of coffee, but they usually just grade papers in the solitude of a quiet room, generally, without kids driving them nuts. And he went to the guidance counselor and said, I want to have Tony come in during my planning period, and I'm going to work one-on-one with him. So I was like, okay, cool. You know, I'm not sure what we're doing. And he said, I want you to pick one drawing or one project. I want you to spend the entire semester on this project. And what this is going to do is it's going to help you have a portfolio piece that can get you into art school and also possibly help you try to get scholarships and financial aid, right?
Wow.
Right? Public school. So I was like, okay, so the first week I'm kind of, to be honest with you, Mike, I'm kind of dilly-dallying. I don't know what the project is. And he's like, you need to, because just because you can draw doesn't mean you have direction. That doesn't mean you know what to do. I mean, imagine if you could play the guitar or the piano. Well, are you playing classical music, rock music, pop music, jazz? There's still a long, it's a long road to figure out who you are. So it was a Friday afternoon. He said, listen, Monday you need to figure out what your project's going to be. Because I don't want this to be a waste of time. I said, okay, fine. So I go home for the weekend. My younger brother's reading Alice's Adventures in Wonderland in elementary school. They were reading it, and he was reading it. And I sat and read some of it with him. And I remembered how much I loved that story when my mom read it to me. And I got this idea. And I came in Monday. I said, I want to illustrate Alice in Wonderland. And he says, okay, that's a good idea. I want you to redesign all the characters. And then I want you to do all your own illustrations, and it's all due at the end of the semester, all these illustrations. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And I mean, when I think about that now, that's 3 months. That's a daunting deadline. It's a lot of drawings, yeah. I got to get done, right?
Right.
So not only is it preparing me for what my life ultimately ends up becoming, but so I just got so into it. I lived and breathed it every night, on the weekends. I couldn't wait to get into doing this. So I would draw it and I colored it. And because I was a teenager and my room was filled with lava lamps and black lights and those flicker light bulbs, I started drawing with a highlighter. I would color it with a highlighter so that it glowed. The illustrations would glow under a black light, right?
Oh, wow.
So I go to bring this in. It's all bound. I Xerox it and staple it and color it. And I hand him the book, and my dad had found a little tiny black light bulb and put it in like a little pen light. So I hand the book to my teacher, and then I hand him this black light to Mr. Wetzel. And we turn the lights off in the room, and he's looking at this thing. And it's glowing like an old Day-Glo poster from the 70s. And he's like, this is amazing. Like, great. So then I'm in class, right? And I'm in class, and this one kid, hey, Dear Lizzie, I hear you got some book that glows in the dark. And I'm like, yeah, you see that. So I hand him the book. Mm. I hand him the pen light. And then before I know it, there's a crowd looking at my art. People that normally wouldn't talk to me, the cool kids, the girls, and they're all looking. And I'm being true to exactly who I want to be. And I got acknowledged in high school.
By the cool kids.
By the cool kids, when I needed it the most. Now I look and go, whatever, it's high school. But at the time, it was everything.
Yeah, certainly.
Everything.
And that speaks to the other side, I guess, of imagination and what you do in terms of the kinds of things that you create through your imagination. Mm-hmm. You create this fantasy world, and it seems that a lot of people are attracted to that.
Yeah.
That explains Dungeons and Dragons. It explains Game of Thrones.
Sure.
It explains Star Wars and anything Tolkien ever wrote. These worlds that don't exist, and we eat them up.
Right.
What is that attraction? What are we looking for as an audience? What are the people who consume what you create, what are they searching for? What does your work do for them?
For them. I can only speak about myself when I read those books or watch those television shows or films and what it gives me and what it's always given me. A safe place to talk about maybe things that are more relevant to our real world than what's happening in the fantasy world. So for instance, when Holly Black and I created the Spiderwick Chronicles, it's all about fairies and goblins and trolls and was made into a movie and by Paramount and stuff. But the core of that story is about a boy dealing with the fact that his parents are going through a messy divorce and how he's really angry that's his reality. And the mom has to custody the kids and she uproots them, brings them to New England. Mm-hmm. And he's really frustrated by that and angry by that. And but it ends with him reuniting his great aunt with her father. So it has this like coping. You know, he's coping with it and dealing with it.
Which leads to a comment from Stephen on Facebook. Tony has wonderful insight to help inspire so many of us and our children. We'll continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest in this segment is Tony DiTalizzi. You may know his work from several of the things that we've talked about. The Sedgwick Chronicles, is that
Spiderwick.
Right? Spiderwick. I'm sorry, the Spiderwick Chronicles. But the important thing for you to know, if you know his work, and if you don't, is that his work is on display. 150 of his works are on display in an exhibit at the Mint Museum on Randolph Road beginning Saturday. It'll be free on Saturday, by the way. Never Abandon Imagination, The Fantastical Art of Tony DiTalizzi. We've talked about your parents. We've talked about your high school upbringing and how all this came together for you in your mind. And we were talking about fantasy and what attracts people to fantasy. And you said you don't really understand it, but it could be that we're searching for metaphors to help us through our daily lives, which leads to a question to somebody who creates fantasy for other people. Do you think about that when you're creating it? Are you thinking about metaphors?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, the best books ask a lot of questions and don't always provide answers. And those are the books for me that after I put them down, I'm thinking about those stories long after I've closed the cover. And that does a couple things for me. It connects, I feel like I'm connected to a bigger society that's thinking about the same things, mulling over the same things. A great example that most people would know would be The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, obviously. Right. Clearly J.R.R. Tolkien was affected by World War I, so war. That he's talking about war and what would motivate certain factions to go to war. Well, that's very relatable to a lot of people. I think Star Wars is another great example of that. And I think in the books, I read the books and seen the TV show of George R.R. Martin and Game of Thrones and Song of Ice and Fire. I think what he displays so effortlessly is that there are no good and there is no good or evil. It's just everyone's motivated, and that also speaks a lot to modern day society.
Star Wars was overwhelmingly popular when the first several movies came out, and then it kind of just weakened over time. The same thing happened with Game of Thrones. People were very unhappy with the last season, and particularly the last episode of Game of Thrones. And I'm wondering if you think, as a creator of these fantasy worlds, that happened in those cases because the progenitors were no longer in charge. The people who started them had moved on and other people began taking over. Like the last season, several seasons of Game of Thrones, the original writer couldn't keep up with the demand for material, so the producers wrote it.
Right, yeah.
No longer his world.
I think it could be that. It also could be, I think when you go back, those are all groundbreaking things. So even... it's so hard, I think, for something to break ground and become a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, you can't bottle that. We all know that. Otherwise, everything would be phenomena. And so to recapture that or recreate that continuously, that's near impossible to do. It's very hard to do. So I think that the unfortunately, the odds are always stacked against them to continue that sensationalized level of appealing to a wide mass.
So you created the Spiderwick Chronicles. It topped the New York Times bestseller list and sold over 15 million copies. I think it was printed in 30 languages or something like that. And then it went on to become a movie called The Spiderwick Chronicles again. Were you in charge of the movie? At least fashioning the script and the visuals.
Holly Black, who I co-wrote it with, and I were very involved with the screenplay. I mean, they had incredible screenwriters that were involved, but Holly and I would kind of consult on it, you know, and offer advice and stuff. The trick with that is it's a different medium, and it's a different you're adapting it into a different form, obviously, and so therefore it has to perform and do different things than a book has to do.
Right.
So there's a lot of letting go of the material. You have to trust that the people who are making this film know what they're doing, and that they certainly had a terrific team that was involved with making that film. And at the end of the day, I thought they did a fine adaptation. I worried that at the time that it came out, we were all the Harry Potter films were coming out. Lord of the Rings had just finished. I felt like, you know, I feel like the audiences might be a little tired of fantasy at that moment. I feel like that stuff kind of comes and goes in fashion.
Okay.
The film still did fine, and it's still loved and you know, celebrated, and I can't be much more happier than that.
Something else that young people should know about you, and you may have mentioned that the exhibit shows your work, your early work, so that young people can see a progression and understand that even though they may not be at your level at the age of 13 that you are today, they may get there someday if
That's
they
right.
keep working at it.
Yes.
Your work, when you first tried to do this professionally, you were rejected.
Many times. Many times.
What kept you going?
You know, it's funny. I just didn't let it grind me down. I actually thought each rejection was just made me that much stronger. I guess I got to a point where I'm like, I have to do this. Like I'm born to do this. I will figure out a way to do this. And it was really important because it still doesn't always come easy to me. I mean, it's not like because I've had these successes that everything I want to do gets done or is successful. There's still people that say no, or I don't know if this is a good idea, or the timing may not be right on this, or, you know, I mean, you still release books and sometimes they don't make it on the bestseller list. And that's good. That's healthy.
We live in a culture that's consumed by fame and
yes.
the desire for fame, and,
yeah.
and it's being fueled rapidly and overwhelmingly by social media. There are all these kids on YouTube now who are only there because they want clicks and they want fame and they want the money that comes with it.
Sure.
I will venture to say, I could be wrong, that you didn't do this for the fame. You didn't do this for the money.
No. I just do it because I love doing it. I have to. I think when you're, in my case, I was a kid who loved to draw. But at a certain point, the drawing became therapy for me as well. It allowed me to sort out the things that I was mulling over in my mind. It allowed me. It's like accessing another part of my brain. And when I'm drawing, I immediately get calm. I immediately feel at ease. If I don't draw on a regular basis, I start to get edgy. And my wife's like, "You need to go draw. Just go." Get it out of your system, whatever you got. So sometimes you just crank the music up, and it's not work. I'm just drawing just for the love and the joy of drawing, and it helps me just calm down. So I think there's many reasons why I create, but the main reason is I absolutely love doing it, and I'm fortunate that I get validated by fans and the Mint Museum and all the folks that will come and tell me that they love my books or they love my art. That keeps me going.
We talk mostly about your fantasy drawings, but you also emulate a lot of different styles. How would you describe your own style? I haven't seen the exhibit, but I did see some selected material from the
Sure.
exhibit. And as I looked through the pictures, I thought, that's different from that one.
Yeah.
That's really different. There's a Norman Rockwell thing in there.
Yeah,
And you say you can't draw like Norman Rockwell. Yes, you can. absolutely. I would have thought it was Norman Rockwell, at least that area of the picture where you're at the easel painting the dragon or whatever that is behind you.
Yes.
That's based on a Norman Rockwell piece.
The triple self-portrait.
Yeah. How would you describe what you do and your style?
Gee, I don't know. I mean, I do look at a lot of the illustrators that came before me and the time in America, well, the world really, when illustration was the visuals before photography.
Right.
Right. So all your media required illustration. And so you saw the rise of unbelievable talents like Norman Rockwell.
Well, he did the Saturday Evening Post cover every week.
Yeah. For decades.
Yeah.
Right. And J.C. Leindecker, who did it before him, was an unbelievable talent. I look at children's book illustration during the golden age of illustration. So that's at the turn of the century. And artists like Arthur Rackham or Ernest Shepherd, who would go on to illustrate Winnie the Pooh. There was a craftsmanship in that work that can be emulated but never be imitated.
And you've talked about being attracted to that work, and particularly Norman Rockwell. You seem to have an affinity for him. Your work was displayed at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Massachusetts,
yes.
which must have been a kick in the head.
I'm not worthy, Mike. I'm not worthy.
What is it about? Because your work is so different. Norman Rockwell, to me, is this New England, very strict, conservative.
Yeah.
And it's in his subject matter. In the way he drew that subject matter.
Right.
It's sparse, just what was needed, no more.
Yes.
To tell whatever story he was telling in that illustration. Yours is phantasmagorical.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you see this connection? What do you get from Norman Rockwell?
I think that I'm just going to push the technical skill aside, but just the staging and the acting. Those characters are acting. It's what you said. I mean, he's doing it with the minimum amount of props that are needed to tell that story. And in
right.
1 second, you're looking at that and you get the whole story. You get the mood, you get the emotion, you get everything. And that is through the acting that the models are doing. It's through the costumes that the models are wearing. It's through the props that are laid around them. It's possibly with the setting, but more often than not, there is no setting
right.
because it would just have the white background.
Just in limbo, yeah.
That is so unbelievably masterful. And bear in mind, he's painting during the Great Depression, during World War, part of World War One, during World War II. He's intentionally painting these happy scenes when the rest of the world feels like it's going down the gutter.
Right.
So, I didn't know that. I asked the folks at the museum about that because I'm like, is this because he was just living this life? And they're like, no, we think that he was consciously doing this as a balm for what the newspapers headlines at the day would have been showing. That's powerful that art could do that.
What were you aware of that when you did the Star Wars book? You have this book called The Adventures of Luke Skywalker,
right.
Jedi Knight, and I think the task, correct me if I'm wrong because it's a little sketchy, but not you, but just what I know about this is sketchy, which is appropriate because you're an artist.
Nice, well done, well played.
Thank you,
that gets a golf clap, that's nicely done.
Puns galore. but you had to distill the original Star Wars series.
Yeah.
And tell the story of that series in 64 pages.
Yes.
That's a lot of time on screen to boil down to 64 pages. I'm not sure how many illustrations that is.
Yes.
But you did it.
So, yeah. So imagine your phone rings and on the caller ID it just says Lucasfilm.
Answer. Quickly.
If I'm dreaming, don't wake me up. So they were like, we're huge fans. George is a fan of your work. I was, of course, very flattered after I picked myself up off the floor, and they said, we would love for you to design a picture book adaptation of Star Wars. And I said, okay. And I'm like, well, when you say Star Wars, what do you mean? The original three films, A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of Jedi. Okay. And we would like you to use Ralph McQuarrie's artwork. Now, Ralph was the concept artist who worked with George in the 70s and 80s. So before they had cast it, before they'd made any of the models or the special effects, George is literally pitching this to the studio to try to get them to make his film about robots and Jedis. He hires an artist to do these paintings of what it could look like.
Mm-hmm.
And this man's name was Ralph McQuarrie. Ralph passed away, I think, in 2012, 2014. My memory's a little sketchy on it now, but see?
Mm.
Yeah. George had all the original paintings in his archive. So I go, I just want to repeat this back to you, make sure I get this right. You want me to retell George's story, the screenplay for the films? Yes. You don't want me to illustrate it. You just want me to use existing art? Yes. So do I give my daughter away on this? Like, what's the catch? And they're like, no, that's it. We know you love Star Wars and we want you to do this. And so, off I went. And it was such a great experience. I really enjoyed doing it because I was a kid who grew up on Star Wars.
Well, let me get this straight. You did not draw the pictures.
That art. That was the other thing I said.
I'm
so
sorry.
Wait, I get paid to do this? Or do I pay you? Like, how does that work?
when you actually do draw the art for you. For your work, do you do it all freehand? Because so much of this has now gravitated toward computers, particularly the coloring of line drawings, like for comic book art. It's gone to computers.
Yeah, that's right.
How
well,
do you do it?
You had asked earlier, you'd said about I change my style up. I try to think of what the story is telling me and try to adjust my mediums, my art tools accordingly. So think of your favorite Beatles song. You're maybe not going to play Revolution on an acoustic guitar. You want an electric guitar.
Right,
but you're not going to play Yesterday with an electric guitar. You want to use an acoustic guitar because that's what the lyrics are kind of telling you to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the same thing when you're picking art and tools. Do I use the hard, crisp line of ink Or do I want this to be more modulated with paint and be more colorful for younger eyes? And so for me, I love using traditional mediums. I still use watercolors. I still use pen and ink. I still use pencil. I will use the computer. The computer's always still involved somehow. I used to do a lot of my cleanup, like fix errors and stuff on the computer. Sometimes we'll assemble multiple pieces together. We'll collage them together on the computer. I have colored stuff on the computer. So it's really more like what feels right for the story. But in general, it's all done old school. Mm-hmm. It's pen and paper, pen and ink on paper or watercolor on paper, which is why we're able to hang it in a museum. Otherwise, there's no physical artwork.
Right. How should people going to this exhibit, whether they know your work or don't know your work, mm-hmm. how should they approach it?
I think I'd love that they don't, if they don't know who I am. I think that'd be terrific, that it would open their eyes, not to who I am specifically, but that the illustrations that go into books for our children, the illustrations that go into some of our favorite pastimes like Dungeons and Dragons or Magic the Gathering requires a hand of an artist. And here are some examples of the art that goes into these things that you may enjoy. One of the things I think about with illustration versus, say, fine art is that when we're children, when we're babies, the first art we're probably shown is board books or picture books. I mean, for my daughter, it was The Very Hungry Caterpillar by Eric Carle. That was the first two-dimensional artwork she was exposed to over and over again for months. Same with Goodnight Moon or, you know, The Little Engine That Could.
Do your kids read your books? I mean, did you read them to them?
I did. Sophia is 12 now, and we have read them, but she grew up around it. So I think it's different for her than maybe it is for other kids that know. So she knows it.
The light bulb gone off that they've seen a piece of art that you're working on in your house?
Yeah.
And suddenly you open this book 6 months later, and there it is. Has the light bulb gone off that this is what Daddy was doing 6 months ago in the studio?
Almost immediately. I remember her dropping her off to preschool, and she said to the other kids, "What books do your mom and dad write?" Because all our friends were, you know, authors and illustrators.
The exhibit at the Mint Museum on Randolph Road, by the way, it's the Mint down there, is called Never Abandon Imagination, The Fantastical Art of Tony DiTerlizzi. And not everybody can use their imagination the way you have in creating these memorable characters and these memorable pictures, but how can ordinary mortals, such as myself, use their imagination to enrich their adult lives? Very quickly, because I'm out of time.
Oh, I mean, I think especially if you're seeing it in your children. I mean, I think that's the advice I often get. I try to give is that if you see your youngster is very imaginative, encourage that, support that. You never know where it could take them. I'm a living example of that.
That's Tony DiTerlizzi. His exhibit opens at the Mint Museum on Randolph Road on Saturday. It's free on Saturday, and it runs through November 3rd. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.